Have you been thinking about people in particular that you want to talk to, send an invitation to? You know, there's some that haven't been in our assembly in quite a long time. And those would be appropriate to contact as well. So think about some of them also and give them a word of encouragement to come and be a part of this. We could, with this lectureship, David could have on the outside of the invitation said, you know, every hour we'll have a door prize given away. Or could have, everybody that comes will get a free pizza down at Simple Simon. Or a variety of things. That would work, wouldn't it? I mean, if that's what we were looking at, simply, well, that'll work. Let's do it. So tonight's sermon is that. Whatever works, question mark. Whatever works. There's a great, great, great Old Testament lesson that illustrates the difference between how man thinks about what works and what God thinks about what works. It's found in 1 Kings chapter 15. 1 Kings chapter 15. It's also found in 2 Chronicles chapters 14 through 16. 2 Chronicles has a much more extended account of it, but we're primarily going to look at 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 15. And it's about King Asa. It's about King Asa. He was one of the first kings, going all the way back almost to the early days of Solomon, that followed what God wanted him to do, that did what was right. There had kind of been a string of kings that weren't too good. And so Asa comes along, and we find a number of great characteristics about him. 1 Corinthians, 1 Kings chapter 15, down in verse 9. We're going to read a little bit about the beginning of his life. 1 Kings 15, verse 9. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king over Judah. And he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His grandmother's name was Maacah, the granddaughter of Abishalom. I want to stop there because there's a lot that is found in 2 Chronicles about what happens during that 41 years. First of all, right after he becomes king, there's 10 years in his reign where it's a very peaceful, restful time. Nothing bad happens. They're not attacked by any enemies. There's no problems in the nation at all. So he begins his reign of 41 years with 10 years of rest. Well, like almost all the kings in the Old Testament, there's always enemies that come to try and do something. And one of those kings, or one of those countries, was the Ethiopians. 2 Chronicles chapter 14. And we want to read a little bit about this because it has a lot to do with what happens later in Asa's life. 2 Chronicles chapter 14. Now remember, he's had 10 years of peace and rest. 2 Chronicles chapter 14, beginning in verse 8. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, who carried shields and spears, and from Benjamin, 280,000 men, who carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. So it's talking about his troops and what he had. Of course, Judah and Benjamin constituted the two southern tribes over which Asa was king. Then Zerah the Ethiopian came out against them with an army of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots. And he came to Marishah. So he had 1,000,000 men, like a regular army, soldiers, 1,000,000 of them, far, far, far more than Asa had. So Asa went out against them, and they set the troops in battle array in the valley of Zephathah at Marishah. And Asa cried out to the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on you, and in your name we go against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God, do not let man prevail against you. So the Lord struck the Ethiopians before Asa and Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. So he had been king for about 10 years. The Ethiopians come up against him with an army twice as big, and they also have chariots. And what does Asa do? He says, I know what I need to do. I simply need to go to God and say, help us. We're going to put our trust in you to take care of the Ethiopians. What happens? God takes care of the Ethiopians. And it's a tremendous, tremendous lesson. So the years go on. He reigns for about another 25, 26 years with nothing of any great consequence happening as far as battles or anything else. Then in the 36th year of his reign, now he had some skirmishes, as we'll see, with the king of Israel during this time. Now these are all God's people, but they're battling each other. King of Israel, king of Judah, they're battling each other, and they kind of battle across border, the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes. They battle and battle and battle kind of over the years, fiercer at times, milder at other times. And so this goes on during a number of years. But then in the 36th year of his reign, he's only got 5 or 6 years left of his reign. In the 36th year, let's go to chapter 15. And notice verse 14. Now there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. So during the time that Baasha was king of Israel, him and Asa, brothers, they had common descendants, so they were relatives. This was kind of a civil war in some respects. So during those years, they were fighting each other. Baasha in the north, Asa in the south, and they were constantly having these skirmishes. Now, Asa had already shown how dedicated he was to doing what was right. Let's read some of the verses prior to that. Verse 12 of 1 Kings 15, talking about Asa. He banished the perverted persons from the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. Also, he removed Maacah, his grandmother, from being queen mother, because she had made an obscene image of Asherah. And Asa cut down her obscene image and burned it by the brook Kidron. Now think about that. His own grandmother, he booted out, because she had made this idolatrous image, this obscene image of a false god. And even though it was his grandmother, what did he do? Out she goes. So this shows, during that time, how devoted he had became to doing what was right. Tore down all the idols and the false god altars and all those things. So that's what he was like. But now, verse 16. Now there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. And Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might let none go out or come into Asa, king of Judah. This was on the road into the city. And so Baasha had came down and kind of built up a kind of a fortified, not really a fort, but it kind of fortified it, built it up so that people couldn't come and go. So he was basically going to come and attack Asa and his forces and his people. Well, here's where Asa had a choice about what to do. Now remember, Baasha was not a major threat to them like the Ethiopians had been years ago. You know, 25 years in the past, Ethiopians had came up against him with 1 million soldiers. He cried out to the Lord. The Lord delivered him, just like that. Delivered the whole nation. Now he had that in mind. He knew that's what he needed to do. But notice now, that's not what he does. How does he think he needs to solve his problem? Oh, he says, I'm going to do something that I think is going to work. I I'm going to do something that I think will work. Me. I'm not going to call on God. I'm going to do something, and it's going to work. Verse 18, what does Asa do? Then Asa took all the silver and gold that was left in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house and delivered them into the hand of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, "Let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. See, I have sent you a present of silver and gold. Come and break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me." Now, just think about what he's doing. Here's Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, who had a treaty with Baasha, king of Israel. So they had a pact. And so here comes Asa saying, "This is going to work. I've got a plan. Not what God wants me to do, but I've got a plan." He says, "I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to outbid Israel for Syria's help. So I'm going to get all the gold and silver in the treasury, and I'm going to send it to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and saying, break your agreement, your contract, your treaty with Israel, and come help us." Why did he need Syria to help? He didn't. But he knew that would work. So instead of doing the right thing, he did what would work. It was his plan all along. This was his plan to do it. I know this will work. So he sent those treasures up to Syria, and let's see what happens. Very next verse. After saying, "Let there be a treaty," so Ben-Hadad heeded King Asa and sent the captains of his armies against the cities of Israel. He attacked Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and all Chinneroth with all the land of Naphtali. Now it happened, when Baasha heard it, that he stopped building Ramah and remained in Tirzah. Wow. End of story. That's a great ending. It worked. It worked, didn't it? His plan was to make sure that Israel stopped building this fortification and left them alone. It worked exactly like he wanted it to work. So his thinking was, well, whatever works, I'm going to do it. And if we didn't have the rest of the story, we might end up with that false impression. But oh my, there's a lot left to this story. Let's turn to 2 Chronicles 16. 2 Chronicles 16, and God does something to Asa. 2 Chronicles 16, down in verse 7. After the plan had worked, after Israel had stopped building Ramah, here's what happens, verse 7. And at that time, Hanani, the seer, the prophet, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, "Because you've relied on the king of Syria and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand." See, Syria actually should have been their enemy. And he's gone now. You made a pact with him, a treaty. He's reminding Asa of what happened. "Were the Ethiopians and Lubim not a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand." See, he's reminding them, that's what you should have done. "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. In this you have done foolishly. Therefore, from now on, you shall have wars." So the remainder of his time, instead of ending his reign in peace, instead of ending his reign with a rest, tranquil period, the rest of those years was marked with wars. Why? Because he called on Syria for help instead of calling on the Lord. He knew it would work to call Syria. I'm going to do what works. But did it? No, it didn't work at all. Why do I think this is a tremendous lesson? When you look out into the world, going back to what I originally mentioned, when you look not just at the denominational world, but certainly there, but in many churches of Christ, this idea of pragmatism, you know, whatever works is okay. If it works, God must approve of it. And often you hear and you read that. Well, we did this, and something good happened, so therefore God must have blessed it. Well, think about what happened with Asa. Didn't something good happen? Absolutely. Israel left them alone. That was a good ending. Did God think it was good? No, not at all. So just because good happens, in your opinion, good happens, doesn't mean God approves of it. Now we need to apply that to the things of the church. Can we have 500 people at this lectureship? Oh, absolutely. That wouldn't be a problem. Is it good to have 500 people? Absolutely. Does that mean that any way of getting 500 people God approves of? No. And we learn that from this account. God is concerned about the process. God is not just concerned about the end. In God's sight, the end does not justify the means. But often in the religious world, that's the case. The end does justify the means. Whatever means you can use is fine if you reach that goal. Whether it's a certain amount of an offering, whether it's a certain attendance, whether it's a certain building maybe, or whatever. And if that's your goal, and it's good, those things are fine. There's nothing wrong with having a big offering, as long as it's used properly. Or a big building, or a lot of people. Those are fine things in and of themselves. But God is concerned how we get there. God is concerned about those things. He was with Asa, and it's the same God that we serve today. And often many of the new things, the innovations in churches are brought about from, well, it works. What happened not too many years ago in the religious world, and it started happening in the Lord's church as well, a lot of people were not coming on Sunday to services. So what happened? They started having Saturday night services, which is very common now throughout the religious world. You can find that in just about any city around here. Several churches in Joplin have Saturday night services. Well, the end justifies the means, according to them. We needed those people to start coming. And there are a lot of people come on Saturday night now. So them said, hey, well, God must approve that then. Good is being done. People are coming. So therefore, God approves of it. Not so. Having the Lord's Supper on Saturday night, or any time on Saturday, or sometimes during weddings, regardless of what day of the week it falls on. But God's been very specific. God says the end does not justify the means. God says the Lord's Supper is supposed to be done on the first day of the week. What other times? None. But we want more people to take the Lord's Supper. That's great. That's good. But it has to be done on the first day of the week. You can't do it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. Asa teaches us that. Whatever works doesn't mean God approves of it. A number of other things have came into the religious world by this idea of pragmatism. Whatever works. Again, attendance started sliding in so many different religious groups. There was this struggle between the traditional church services in most Protestant-type churches and what they would see in the entertainment world. People were becoming very used to an entertainment-type format. whether it's on TV or in games or at Broadway or whatever. Commercials, everything was geared toward that. So they had all of that in the world, and then when they came to the church services, there wasn't any entertainment. So what do you do? Well, the end justifies the means. So let's make the church services more like the world, and we'll get more people. Well, of course that works. Does God approve of it? No. Asa teaches us that. So whatever works is not what the Bible says. It's not what the Bible teaches. We can get more people by having a symphony. Probably could. I don't know what kind of symphony we could put together with this group, but I doubt that would attract too many people. But in some congregations, you could probably put together quite an amazing symphony. You probably could. And that would get a lot of people to come just to hear the symphony. They may not hear anything else. Well, that's good. You got them to come. So therefore, God blesses that. Regardless of how we got them there or what we've done or how we're doing it, God approves of it. Asa got something done that was good. Got Israel to stop, and Israel left. That was good. God said, no, it wasn't good. Because you didn't seek me, but you did whatever you wanted to do, then I'm going to make you and your people have wars throughout the rest of your reign. Why? Because you didn't seek me. God says you always have to do that. If we're going to worship Him, we have to seek God. If we want to have more people in attendance, we have to seek God. When can we have the Lord's Supper? It's not up to us. We have to seek God. What does He say? And on and on and on the list goes. And much about the lectureship coming up is about the difference between the world and the truth. And often there's a great difference. But the lesson we learned tonight is that the end does not justify the means. The world says it does, by and large. But God says, no, it doesn't. And as we end, I want to look at two verses in 2 Chronicles 15, verses 1 and 2. Which will serve as an invitation as well. 2 Chronicles 15. Now the Spirit of God came unto Azariah the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa and said to him, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with Him. If you seek Him, He will be found by you. But if you forsake Him, He will forsake you. See, that was the lesson Asa had to learn. He had seen it in practice with the Ethiopians, but when it came down to Israel, his neighbor, his enemy to the north, he didn't. And God said, if you don't forsake me, I won't forsake you. That's the same God. The God that says the end doesn't justify the means. If we want God's blessing and approval, we must seek Him, not just what works. Because God doesn't approve that. We have to seek Him. And He doesn't give us additional revelations today. He doesn't send us visions or angels to tell us things. He's told us, and now it's set. So if we seek Him, we seek His Word in everything we do. When we stop doing that, when we stop listening to Him, He's going to forsake us, plain and simple. Whether it has to do with salvation, the world teaches the end justifies the means. That's not what God says. God says, don't forsake me or I'll forsake you. Jesus said there was one way to the Father and there's only one way to the Father. And that was through Him. And the Bible teaches we are, for those penitent believers, we're to be immersed, fully immersed, baptized, buried in water for the forgiveness of sins. And then we're to continue to have a life of penitence, of confession. And that's how we're to live the rest of our life, always seeking Him. But He says if we start to forsake Him, He's going to forsake us. So the lesson is yours. If you need to respond tonight, we encourage you to come as we stand to sing this song.